Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and in this episode, we're bringing together four of the most compelling talks from our archive, each focused on a different aspect of the same issue, sustainability in food production. We start with Dr. Kali Shatakondu, Global Commercial Director of Arborea. He's talking about a technology he calls a breathing cultivation system. He opened his talk at our Rotterdam event in September 2025 with some startling numbers.
I'd like to start actually by asking a question. So could it really be true that every hour a forest area the size of 18 football fields is destroyed? And it might be surprising, but actually that's not true. It's every minute that that happens. And this deforestation, food and feed demand for fertile land, is something that is basically a crisis for the world. And it's not just about fertile land. We have a situation whereby within 5 years, the world will, the demand for fresh water will exceed supply by 40%. By 2050, most of the soil on the planet will have degraded. And according to a recent study, we all carry the equivalent already of 5 plastic caps worth of microplastics in our brains. So something has to be done about that. But what if you could, instead of emitting carbon dioxide, capture it and convert it into food? What if you had a technology that didn't need any fertile land at all, so therefore no deforestation, no loss of biodiversity? A technology that used minimal fresh water, was easily scalable with low capex, no fermentation tanks, no pressurized gases, no cross-contamination risks from open ponds, etc., and you effectively can provide food security to any country in the world. No tariffs either, actually. So if I introduce the world's first breathing cultivation system. Okay. This is a technology that works rather like the human lungs. So we have a mechanism in our bodies whereby we breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. This system does it in reverse. This can breathe in carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen as the byproduct. The carbon dioxide can come from any source. It can come from any industry, non-pressurized. It can come from burning agricultural waste, and you're breathing out pure oxygen as a byproduct. And with this mechanism, you can then cultivate microalgae. You can cultivate it such that you can harvest every single day microalgae. You have 365 harvests rather than one. And from the microalgae, you can extract a whole range of food ingredients, proteins, colors, lipids, bioactive vitamins and minerals. You don't need expensive fermentation tanks. You don't have the cross-contamination risks of open ponds. You don't have expensive internal photobioreactors. We've got a facility in Portugal, a one-to-one pilot facility in Portugal, that demonstrates exactly the techno-economic advantages of a method like this. It's modular, it's scalable, and it means that instead of capturing carbon and burying it, often with and getting carbon credits, often with taxpayers' money, and generating $100 a ton for the carbon dioxide, we can capture it and convert it into food instead, make $5,000 a ton. Effectively, then, barren land can become cultivatable farmland. So farmers can actually start to make large quantities of food on barren land. And this can therefore happen anywhere in the world with this technology. 2 tons of carbon dioxide becomes 1 ton of food. But why microalgae? 3 billion years ago, the atmosphere of the planet was very different to We're trying our best to get back to that atmosphere, I think, at the moment from what we're doing. But 3 billion years ago, the atmosphere was very largely carbon dioxide. Microalgae came along, started eating that carbon dioxide, emitting oxygen, and that's what we breathe today. They were the origin of life. They are packed, therefore, with nutrients. And today we're talking about positive nutrition. It's all present within these microalgae. You notice the composition here, a huge quantity of protein, not just any protein, a full amino acid profile protein with branched chain amino acids and amino acids that are essential to health. You've got bioactive vitamins and minerals, B1, B2, B3, B6, B12, iron, zinc, magnesium, all in a bioactive form that the cells of the body recognize. If you take it in an inorganic form, cells will just flush out those minerals. In this form, the cells recognize it and take it in. You also have valuable fatty acids there. You have valuable carbohydrates there, all within microalgae. This is the composition of spirulina, but this same technology can make any microalgae, any of the 30,000. So any nutrition, any ingredient found in any microalgae can all be made with this same process, all from carbon dioxide.
Now, roughly 30 to 40% of all food we produce never gets eaten. That's not only a waste problem, it's also contributing to climate change. Amanda Ohnbrink is CEO of the Upcycled Food Association, a trade body that spent 5 years building the infrastructure, certification standards, and market for upcycled food. That's ingredients that would otherwise leave the food system entirely, being given a second life in something people actually buy and eat. She spoke to us at our Manchester event in November 2024.
5 years ago, when UFA got started, one of its founding tasks was to define upcycled foods. The three pillars that helped found our organization were aligning on the fact that upcycled foods use ingredients that otherwise would not have gone to human consumption, are procured and produced using verifiable supply chains, and have a positive impact on the environment. So let's dive in. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the global challenge of food waste is massive. Of all food produced, 30 to 40% is lost or wasted each year. And this total impact, if it were a country, would be the fifth largest emitter. So why upcycling? These numbers are specific to the U.S., but U.S. nonprofit ReFED has measured a span of solutions that address food waste, and upcycling is a top 10 in those impact numbers, both in terms of food waste diverted, emissions reduced, and water saved. But beyond that, thinking about waste being transformed from a cost center into a revenue driver and the amount of jobs it can create along the way. This new innovation is available, is here, is happening, and is deserving of increased investment. The market size of the total opportunity is vast. The opportunity spans many segments, from traditional food products, pet, cosmetics, home and personal care, and new innovations happening all the time. So what are some of the benefits involved in upcycling innovation? There's the cost reduction I mentioned, thinking about how to transform previously wasted value streams and turning them into a revenue driver. There's the ability to capture otherwise wasted nutrition. And then there is the overall impact of how decreasing food waste can help in the fight against climate change. This is increasingly important in terms of decisions individuals can make. The nonprofit Project Drawdown measured a span of solutions in terms of what individuals can do to be drawing down climate. And amongst their scientific survey of solutions, reducing food waste is the top solution. We also were encouraged at the end of last year, the United States Environmental Protection Agency updated what had been its previous food waste hierarchy to now be the wasted food scale. The first and foremost advice is to in any moment possible prevent food waste. But when that is not possible, the next best solutions in terms of impact are to donate. And in this evolution, upcycling was elevated in terms of options for where to be diverting. So that's what we're all about at the Upcycled Food Association and the Upcycled Food Foundation. We exist to accelerate the upcycled food economy globally, unleashing innovation to stop food waste. We do this in several different ways, through collaborating amongst our members, through driving scientific research, to being a voice representing our members and policy, and increasingly educating both stakeholders across the supply chain and food consumers. Our membership spans the supply chain. We're really proud to be working with over 200 members globally, whether they have an upcycled product yet or not. Our members span the supply chain from R&D and innovation, ingredient suppliers, CPG and food companies, small to large, as well as distributors, retailers, and academic research. UFA is unique in that we do draw from the perspectives of a global membership. Part of our mission is to educate consumers and increase the adoption and awareness of upcycling. And in doing so, really helping create the market for these amazing products. As I mentioned, we are a collective voice in policy moments, as well as in media with press. And we have a strong foundation of academic participation, really moving this cutting edge forward. We are 5 years young as of this October, really began with strongly defining upcycled foods, and then quickly moved into developing the standard that became Upcycled Certified, the mark that launched in North America in 2021 and has grown globally since then. At the close of last year, our partner, Where Food Comes From, that had worked with us since the beginning of the standard, acquired Upcycled Certified, and they are now the partner with UFA in growing global certification. And Upcycled Certified has seen really strong growth. It's exciting to be at these points of seeing over 100 participants since the certification launched in 2021, and over 560 items, products, or ingredients have been certified. Sum total of that impact to date, 1.9 million tons of food waste has been diverted. And these numbers of the growth across total food and beverage as of July of this year, 2024, show really strong uptake. Strong growth, especially across snack, beverage, and pet food.
So the market is moving, but a question that came up repeatedly at our London Sustainable Food Forum was whether the economics are moving fast enough and who across the supply chain is actually doing the work. Anne-Marie Butler is Global Director of Strategy and Innovation at Edlong.
So this is a really exciting time for the food industry. I have never been involved in so much new and interesting innovation. Now, I am an animal for a good stainless steel plant. So equipment and processing are some of the things I love. And we're seeing such an influx of innovation on that side that facilitates, it doesn't sound exciting, but if you can improve a process, it means that you might be able to extend shelf life. Or you might be able to change where it sits in a supermarket so it's not taking up as much energy. It doesn't need to be refrigerated. Transportation costs are less. So starting from the beginning, we're seeing new equipment come out there, even from a flavor perspective, better ways to retain flavor so you're not getting as much loss, which in turn makes our products stronger, less usage, less packaging required to ship it, better for our customers. So there's a knock-on effect to everything you look at. Some of the most interesting ingredients I'm seeing are in the plant-based meat space, the alternative space. 3D printing has really facilitated some really interesting innovations. Packaging is one that I think fits really nicely with sustainability. We're seeing a lot of companies change over their packaging so that it is more sustainable. The lids in particular, a lot of the times you'll read a package and it will say recyclable, and then you dig into the back and the lid isn't recyclable, or the plastic wrap around it isn't recyclable, so it's not fully. And now we're seeing massive influx in packaging that facilitates the shelf life you need, the shipping, doesn't impact the taste, the colour, but is recyclable or is compostable even better. So there's a massive amount of new innovations, but I think we could be here all day if I was going to go through every one of them. It's an exciting time in the food industry. Every time you walk into the supermarket, I'm sure every one of you have seen something new or different every day. It's not just a once a week launch. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say in terms of innovations is communication with consumers in the space. Again, I'm going to quote you another percentage, 62%. That is the percentage of consumers who feel more enamored by a brand that communicates the challenges they're having in embracing sustainability and how they might be unable to achieve full sustainability within their process. And what that means is that company, I don't know if you're familiar with Perfect Day, the Urgent company, they recently put on their package that they were struggling to make the product and the process fully sustainable, but they were on a journey and they appreciated their customers supporting them. They saw their sales grow massively as a result of that. Consumers want to feel part of the journey in how we make our products sustainable. And I think even the communication that we're doing in that can be innovative, and it's worth spending time on.
Innovation on the product side is accelerating, but all of it needs to be pointed at a target. The UK food and drink industry is committed to net zero emissions by 2050. The Food and Drink Federation has set a voluntary target of net zero by 2040. Emma Pearcey is head of climate change and energy policy at the FDF, and Matt Lucci is founder of Canopy Consulting. In this section of their conversation, they break down the actual emissions structure of the UK food and drink sector.
Emma, what are the easiest parts of the industry to get to net zero, and which are the sticking points? Where are the tricky bits?
Well, I think for food and drink manufacturers, the part of the carbon footprint, shall we say, that they can impact on most directly themselves is, of course, their own Scope 1 and 2 emissions, their on-site emissions, effectively, the energy they're using on-site. So, you know, examples of that would be, obviously, with electricity usage and in their processes, generating, you know, heat and steam through boilers or through CHP. But those are the kind of examples, and basically how they can reduce their energy consumption and the energy that they're using, how that can be sort of taken to net zero. So that is an area where they have sort of direct impact or control. But should we say the unfortunate thing in this context is that actually when we look at the full carbon footprint from food and drink manufacturers, the Scope 1 and 2 emissions accounts for roughly 10 to 15%. The majority of the carbon footprint is actually with the supply chain. Mm. And that is the Scope 3 emissions. So that is the much bigger challenge. And so, you know, that is one of the reasons, well, that's the reason why, of course, you know, working with stakeholders across the farm to fork supply chain is critical to be able to start making impactful progress in that area. And there are a lot of industry initiatives that are growing in that area at the moment as well.
So can you give us a little bit more detail about Scope 3? What's included within that?
Well, I'm just wondering, actually, Matt, this might be a better one for you to talk about. So I'll pass over to you in a moment. But for me, the key thing that comes to mind, actually, the biggest area is around ingredients. Mm. The ingredients that you use in your products, that is where you get the most sort of embodied carbon. But given that we're undertaking our roadmap to net zero at the moment, I shall pass on to Matt to comment on that question more.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. And so our colleagues at 3Keel, in conjunction with RAP, have been trying to run the numbers on the food and drink sector's carbon impact in the UK. And just a few headlines from that. Emma said that the ingredients piece was fundamentally important. So the UK agricultural footprint of the food and drink sector is about 39%, so nearly 40% of emissions come from UK agriculture. About 22%, so just over a fifth of all food and drink related emissions are imported emissions associated with ingredients. So that's ingredients that are produced by manufacturers, by agriculture outside of the UK. About 4% of emissions come from packaging. If you think about what's within the direct control of a food and drink manufacturer and the manufacturing processes that they have, so that's the scope 1 and 2 emissions, as we might talk about it, that's just 6% of UK food and drink emissions. 5% is then transport related. 11% is associated with retail and catering operations. 12% sits with consumers and things like home cooking of products. And then about 1% is post-consumer, so waste disposal. So when you look at the emissions that are directly within the gift of food and drink manufacturers to own and influence, it's only 6% of a very large picture, as Emma was sketching.
Yeah. This also brings to mind the trickiness of the fact that a lot of this is dependent on things like a national infrastructure program, which is an element that's out of your hands. So we mentioned hydrogen fuel infrastructure. You talked about overhead electric cabling for powering vehicles. I'm thinking recharging networks for cars. Now, these are outside of the scope. They're not within your gift to control. Could this put the target in jeopardy?
Yeah, so in terms of the dependence that I think food and drink manufacturers will have on others, in a sense, to build that necessary infrastructure, clearly I think in terms of hydrogen, that will be one aspect, because of course food and drink manufacturing is more in dispersed manufacturing sites, not in industrial clusters. But that, I think, actually means for food and drink that actually we'll probably use more blended gas, hydrogen up to about 20% in the network potentially. So that relies on sort of government policy to be able to incentivize that. There will also be a reliance on, of course, necessary electricity grid infrastructure, especially as we're looking to move to more electrification, given the assumptions around the electricity grid decarbonizing to net zero. So there is that dependence, but of course, that does mean that we very much need to work as an industry, but across other industrial sectors as well, within our sort of local regions, in area to area, communicating with DNOs, the distribution network operators, you know, the other key stakeholders who manage this infrastructure, to get that information across of what is needed. And I think Ofgem, in their work on sort of the business plans over the next 5-10 years, working with those stakeholders, are very much mindful of these developments that will take place. So I think it's very important that all key stakeholders are, you know, talk to each other, work together, and we are doing that. So communication, I think, is key, which is something we, you know, manufacturers can engage with. I think more broadly about the dependency on others to do things, it's not possible to give responsibility to one party. And so as an example around looking at how to calculate supply chain emissions, I mean, as one example, we are all convening with RAP in terms of the different stakeholders across the farm to fork value chain, coming together to look at how we can create an aligned industry methodology and subsequently data sources to be able to agree to that. So there's just a lot of collaboration and cooperation that is required that we will be very much part of, along with others as well.
Now, Matt, I guess there are a couple of ways to attack this, aren't there? You can either reduce emissions and deal with the infrastructure and the change that you need to achieve fundamental shifts in how you work, or you can offset. Now, is offsetting cheating? Or is there a balance between the two?
Good question. Offsetting is not cheating, but the real challenge ahead of us is to get carbon out of the system. So we need to decarbonize as fast and as far as we can. I think I'd encourage everybody to gear all their efforts to taking carbon out of the system.
So it's clear there is still work to do across the whole food chain, which makes the stories we've heard today all the more important. None of this is solved, but all of it is moving, and faster than the headlines often suggest. We'll keep following it here on the Food Matters Live podcast. If you want to explore any of these conversations in full, head to the Food Matters Live website and search podcasts. And it's not too late to sign up for our next live event. We're in London on June 3rd and 4th. You can find more details at foodmatterslive.com.